Welcome to the Jaharis podcast on health law and intellectual property. With me today is Ignacio Cofone, who is an assistant professor and Norton Rose Fulbright faculty scholar at McGill University Faculty of Law, where he teaches privacy law, business associations, and artificial intelligence law. Before joining McGill, Cofone was a research fellow at the NYU Information Law Institute, a resident fellow at the Yale Law School Information Society Project, and a legal advisor for the City of Buenos Aires. He obtained a PhD from Erasmus University Rotterdam and Hamburg University and a JSD from Yale Law School. His research explores how the law should adapt to technological change with a focus on privacy and algorithm decision making. The episode today will address Ignacio's recent paper, Immunity Passport and Contact Tracing Surveillance, forthcoming in Stanford Technology Law Review. Welcome, Ignacio. It is so good to have you with us today. I'm especially interested in your paper because it is quite close to a paper that I have written. And so before we dive into the arguments and the ideas, I would be very interested to hear what are the technologies that we're talking about when we're talking about this paper.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon, for having me here. I'm very happy to chat about the paper with you. So we're talking basically about two different technologies. One of them that people are quite familiar with at some point are contact tracing apps, and the other one are immunity passports, which they share a number of elements in common, but also some important differences, right? So contact tracing apps aim to monitor spread by evaluating who may have been in contact with someone who tested and reported to be positive for COVID-19. And immunity passports aim to contain spread by certifying who is believed to be immune from COVID-19. So in different ways, they both aim to allow countries and states to reopen the economy safely while having in place measures of digital containment to reduce the spread.
Great. Basically, we're talking about different stages of the pandemic. One was more at the beginning and the other one now, when there is some sort of vaccine or people that have been sick and are immune.
So yes and no. It is true that contact tracing apps were very popular at the beginning of the pandemic, and immunity passports are becoming popular later on, but they don't necessarily belong to different stages of the pandemic. It's just that that's how the technology evolved. For example, immunity passports can be based on vaccine data, or they can also be based on negative PCRs or serology tests. That's why I think immunity passports is a better term than vaccine passports, even though some of them are exclusively for vaccines. They could have been useful also at the beginning of the pandemic, just certifying who recently got a negative PCR or who recently got a negative serology, so antibody test. They were not so popular back then, I believe, well, partly because the technology was not developed back then, and partly because serology tests are quite inaccurate, or there are doubts about how accurate they would be, and so are the rapid antigen tests that people take. Developing the app solely for PCR tests may not have been particularly useful. Well, now with vaccines, vaccine data is much more readily accessible than data on serology tests, on PCR tests, and it is more useful for people who got the vaccine to have the passport. More useful now, but I don't think they necessarily belong to the end state of the pandemic. And contact tracing apps similarly were quite useful at the beginning, according to epidemiologists, but they continue to be useful at least until we reach herd immunity, which is not going to happen anytime soon. So in many countries, it will take a lot of time for it to happen. Very few countries are as advanced with vaccine rollout as the US and Israel are. And even in the US, to the extent that a fraction of the population refuses to get the vaccine, so herd immunity is not reached, contact tracing apps could be useful. Now you may say, well, you know, people who refuse the vaccine would also not get a contact tracing app because they may not want the app for similar reasons that they may not want the vaccine. But even for people that got only one dose, or for people that cannot get the vaccine, or for people that recently got it, and there are a number of reasons for which anti-herd immunity, the contact tracing apps, could continue to be used.
In the most ideal circumstances, what is the greatest promise that these apps hold?
The promise that these apps hold, and I'm not saying that they deliver that promise, is that they can surveillance technology, or they can use data to contain the pandemic while reopening the economy in ways that the world couldn't do before, right? This is the first time that humanity meets a pandemic with the ability to use digital tracing and digital certification of immunity to stop it. So the promise that they hold is governments can do fewer lockdown measures that they would otherwise need to, because this technology can contain it, or can help contain it.
And you mentioned that they do not necessarily deliver. So what are the trade-offs? What do we lose in exchange of this great promise?
So I believe that whether they deliver on the promise and the costs of delivering on the promise are perhaps different questions. Whether they deliver on the promise, I'm maybe not the one that's most qualified to answer. I would ask an epidemiologist about that, but from the material that has been published, contact tracing apps are more effective when a large chunk of the population adopts them. There was an initial threshold, 60%, that was then declared to be a misunderstanding, but they become more useful at 25% adoption, and very few countries that rolled out contact tracing apps actually reached the 25% adoption. No US states that rolled out contact tracing apps reached the 25% adoption. So then they become obviously less useful then. As to what we lose, what we may lose are the consequences of, first of all, the consequence of the surveillance technology that is deployed, and because of the way that the surveillance technology is distributed, we may lose in basically in privacy and inequality in a number of ways that can be mitigated but cannot be eliminated.
How can they be mitigated?
So it depends for which risk we're talking about. Let's take privacy, for example, and let's take contact tracing apps to start. Contact tracing apps can be perhaps most relevantly distinguished along two lines. One of them is whether they're based on Bluetooth or on GPS data, and the other one is whether they're localized or they have distributed storage, and they use some sort of distribution mechanism for that. Apps based on GPS will necessarily be more invasive than apps based on Bluetooth, simply because GPS is much more informative than Bluetooth is about other information that is irrelevant for containment, that is necessarily conveyed. So, for example, your GPS data combined with other data can tell people who you were with, for how long you were with them, where you were, what stores you went to, and so on and so forth. And because GPS data is quite granular, GPS data also means that any promise of anonymity or the identification that the apps may have are quite thin. But then there are other apps that are based on Bluetooth, and they're based on Bluetooth. So instead of measuring location, they measure proximity. That data is less granular, is less easy to re-identify a person based on Bluetooth data. And it is informative of other things than proximity with someone who may have been infected. And also importantly, very few apps store all data in one central database, and other apps store most of the data on people's phones, and the matching itself is done on people's phones. And the only thing that is transmitted is the information of what token was in contact with this other token. And that way, the privacy risks are reduced. Of course, the privacy risks are not eliminated, because we know from all the privacy literature that you're also familiar with that data is never truly anonymous. Data can be de-identified, but can also be re-identified with enough effort. And any app, contact tracing or otherwise, can be subject to a number of attacks that that we identify the information. The amount of security that an app has can make it more difficult to re-identify. It can make it extremely difficult to re-identify, but never impossible. Keeping the data decentralized is a very good way to reduce the privacy risk. And using proximity data on the Google, Apple API is much better than using location data. But we also have to understand that doesn't mean that the privacy risks are totally eliminated or that anonymity is perfect, just that we have a reasonable way to mitigate them.
I don't know if I'm encouraged or discouraged by your conclusion.
Neither do I.
So let's talk about inequality. Is there perspectives to mitigate inequality? And well, first explain how it challenges inequality, but then could that be better mitigated?
So we talked about contact tracing apps for the priority. So let's talk about immunity passports for the inequality risk. So immunity passports can increase inequality in two distinct ways. One way that they can increase inequality is by who can hold the app. So there are a number of people that do not have smartphones with the capability of holding an app, be it a contact tracing app or an immunity passport app. And if we create a system of privileges where people who hold the immunity passports can have access to certain things, and people who do not hold immunity passports do not have access to those things, that means that we would create a system in which people who do not have these particular types of phones are systematically excluded. And so immunity passports can be used for international travel, as they're sometimes proposed, or they can also be used for internal restrictions, right? For going to school, to work, to the cinema, and so on and so forth. So if they are used only for international travel, maybe this problem is less severe. But if they're used for internal restrictions, this means excluding certain groups of the population, such as perhaps the homeless or other populations that are already marginalized, and increase their marginalization through this system of privileges. And the second way that they can feed inequality is, so immunity passports, we can separate them in three based on what data they accept. Some are just vaccine passports, right? So some just certify vaccine status to reduce a number of restrictions for those who have been vaccinated. Other types of passports, such as, for example, the Danish passport, also recognize PCR tests. So people that recently had a negative PCR test, so that, for example, they want to fly somewhere, they're not vaccinated, they're allowed to fly with a negative PCR test. And instead of bringing the actual PCR certificate, it gets inputted into the app. I don't think any app that has been implemented anywhere yet, but some of the proposed apps also take negative serology tests, so antibody tests that show that you recently contracted COVID-19, but you recovered, and so you're temporarily immune because of that. Depending on what type of data we use, these also can trace inequality in a number of ways, because to the extent that vaccines are widely distributed, then choosing the app based on vaccine data would be the least problematic. But if we take also serology tests or we take PCR tests as well, first of all, we're taking some risks on accuracy, because we know that serology tests are not that accurate. And same if we take antigen tests that are not PCR. But beyond that, the apps and tracing inequality to the extent that there is inequality in access to medicine. And maybe you think like, well, this is not that bad. Access to medicine is quite evenly distributed. But I would argue that depends on where you're at. In many parts of the US, access to medicine is not very equally distributed. And I would be hesitant to magnify that unequal distribution to a system of access where, depending on the access that people have to that medicine, they can go to bars, go to clubs, go to football matches, or they can
go to work.
Oh, go to work. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think the way to mitigate that problem, although it would of course not eliminate it, would be to first of all have the immunity passports based on vaccine data. So to have them actually be vaccine passports and not vaccine plus PCR plus antigen. And particularly to address the first problem of not everyone has a smartphone that can support it, to have a printable option. So this is, for example, what what the EU does with the digital green pass. You have a QR code that is stored in your phone, but you can also print it. So to the extent that you have access to a printer, you can do that. And we could even do a system where, together with the Immunity Passport app, people get some sort of card so that it also doesn't depend on their access to a printer. And people can use that card with the QR code, and then the information on vaccines feeds onto the personalized QR code that they hold in the card. And that would significantly reduce the first problem that we're talking about.
Will this be operated through a website that you can just access from a regular computer?
So there are many ways to do it. One way to do it is to have a personalized QR code for each person, and that QR code can hold any sort of information. You could use distributed ledgers such as blockchain, so that the information is not stored centrally, but it's rather distributed, and the information, the QR code, is not centrally contained, but it's rather used for verification. So you could use it in such a way that the state has information on which QR code belongs to each person. Vaccination sites can certify the person that this QR code belongs to had a first dose or had a second dose, and then participating businesses or participating entities can then scan the QR code, and without getting all the information about the person, they can get the verification about whether they're vaccinated or not, which wouldn't work too differently from health cards with a barcode already.
In this sense, it's the two-edged sword, right? So on the one hand, it protects privacy more than other potential approaches we can take on this thing. And on the other side, we can see that it does surveil you. So maybe it can relatively protect other health information, but then the trade-off is that it requires more surveillance information, maybe more location information at the expense of health information.
Right. So surveillance is inevitable. So what we were just talking about is perhaps the Immunity Passport app that would have the least impact on privacy and would have the least impact on inequality, but it would inevitably surveil you. Yeah, and that's the policy decision that has to be made. And maybe the surveillance there is worth it. Maybe the surveillance there is worth it for certifying who's vaccinated and who's not vaccinated in an at least accessible way. That would certainly be better than other options for immunity passports that, for example, do continuous tracking. So there are a couple of immunity passports apps around the world that track your location 24/7, that you have to activate your location. That would be clearly undesirable. If you have a system where you have a card with a QR code or an app that does not necessarily track your location, surveillance is inevitable, because every time the QR code is scanned, then location is revealed, right? But if you don't centralize this information and you have the printable option, so you're absolutely sure that the location tracking is not continuous, at least that reduces the privacy concern. So I think you're right that surveillance is inevitable. The two questions to be asked from a policy perspective are, first of all, how can we mitigate the surveillance to have a smaller impact on privacy and a smaller impact on inequality while having the main function that we want from the systems? That's the first question. And the first question is, now that we know what is the minimum surveillance that we can exert while having a functional system, whether the system is worth it.
And does it matter to you if the design requires autonomous choice of users to use the app or not? Because if it's a policy decision, then you can say that if I'm required to have this app in order to go to work, then it's not really a free choice thing, right?
Exactly. So that's the thing, right? So in theory, we want people to freely choose whether they want to use the apps or not. But in practice, and particularly with immunity passports, the extent to which this choice is really free is questionable. So we can condition, if we condition certain things on having the app, not only the vaccine card that we get when we're vaccinated, but actually the app that exerts some sort of surveillance, to what extent are we really choosing to have it? And this partly depends on what things we condition on it. So if the app is only used for international travel, then maybe we consider this to be unacceptable for imposed surveillance, because we're used to being surveilled very heavily when we do international travel, right? But this would certainly be different if we require the app to go to work or to school or to go to different venues. And again, the answer may still be yes. The answer may still be that this imposed surveillance is worth it to reopen the economy safely. But regardless of what the policy answer is, which depends on a number of factors, it is important to keep the trade-offs in mind.
And I could play the devil's advocate and say that if all it shows is that you have been vaccinated, then why do I need the surveillance part if I can just show a card that says that I have been vaccinated? Why do I need to be surveilled for that? Right.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So the argument here, and I'm going to play my own devil's advocate, would be, vaccine certificates can easily be falsified. And so we need some sort of secure system that certifies immunity and that is not so easy falsifiable. And we know, for example, that the little yellow booklets for the yellow fever passports are sometimes falsified and so on and so forth. And that is true. But one could also just design vaccine cards that have more security measures like passports, if that is the end.
I have saved the most intriguing question, I think, to the end.
Okay.
And this is, why do we talk about these technologies together? I mean, you have given examples about each technology separately, and I completely understand. But what do they have in common, or why should we address them together?
I think while keeping present that they're different in a number of ways, it is useful to discuss them together because they both use surveillance as a measure for containment, and the risks that they create because of that particular type of surveillance are similar. So they both pose risks to privacy and inequality because of the type of surveillance that they need to use to be functional and because of the uneven way that this surveillance is distributed in a way that those risks can often be mitigated in similar ways. So, for example, we were talking about decentralized use of the app. Having them decentralized is something that is desirable for both of them. We talked about non-continuous GPS tracking. Non-continuous GPS tracking is something that is good for both of them. We discussed the inequality that is produced by the fact that only people that actually have smartphones that are new enough to support them can benefit from the apps, and that also exists for both of them, and the mitigation strategies are similar for both of them. So obviously contact tracing apps kind of be printed into a QR code, but we could say that they should be expanded to older phones as well to reduce this problem. So the ways of reducing them might be different, but the problem is similar. Seeing how it is the type of surveillance that they exert that creates this risk and their ways to mitigate them may lead to productive ways in which what we discussed so far for contact tracing apps can to a certain extent also be used for immunity passports.
So it's kind of a lesson learned from what we already know about the digital tracing apps.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know how much less. I don't know how much we actually learned.
Right.
But yeah, certainly we could learn things from the experience so far from contact tracing apps to apply to the coming immunity passports.
From what I know, the problem with digital tracing apps is that there's so many ways to design them, and there are so many parameters, and each parameter affects differently the questions of privacy and inequality. And so the more variations there are for these apps, the fewer generalizations we can make about the tracing apps in general, other than what you have highlighted, which is the surveillance and the privacy issue and the inequality.
So I think that's why it can be useful to treat them together so that we don't get lost in the trees. I think it is useful to talk about containment apps, to include both contact tracing apps and immunity passports and learn from the things they have in common. Because once we abstract from the different technical aspects, and the different technical aspects are important and they can make a difference and they can mitigate this risk. But once we see more broadly what are the general risks that we want to mitigate and what are the general lessons, not only we can draw lessons from the immunity passports that are coming, but we can also take these lessons for the mitigation of future health crises.
Yeah, I understand that. So do you think, suspect or predict that the immunity apps would be more prevalent than the digital tracing apps, that they will catch more?
Do you mean in terms of how many countries implement them, or do you mean it in terms of how many people download them?
In terms of policy, will government obligate people to use them? Because I think that the idea about the digital tracing apps would, in most places of the world, although not in all of them, was that we should leave it to the autonomous decision of users, right? But with digital, with immunity apps, I think that if the government provides the vaccine, maybe it has more right to demand that you show that you are immune somehow.
I don't know about that. It is true that the information on who is vaccinated is more public than the information of who you've been in contact with, but that's not the only information that the apps reveal. And there is a step from show immunity, for example, through a vaccine certificate. There's a step from that to download this surveillance app called Immunity Passport. Now, do I think that many countries will move to use them? Yes. I don't know how many will for internal restrictions and how many will for international travel. I suspect more will for international travel than for internal restrictions. Perhaps the most important difference in terms of implementation with regards to contact tracing apps is not how many countries try to implement them, because many countries implement contact tracing apps too. The main difference is that people that get vaccinated are probably very likely to want to use an immunity passport versus contact tracing apps that had a very low adoption rate.
Right. That's a very good point, of course. I think that this puts us in a kind of an optimistic a note to end this conversation, because let's hope that everybody who wishes to would have access to vaccines and would have a very, very strong interest in showing that they're vaccinated.
Well, let's hope that people have access to vaccines, and yeah.
That's a very optimistic
and
note.
And they use their chance, yeah.
Yeah. So thank you very, very much, Ignaz, to join us on the Jaharis podcast today. And I look forward to reading more of your work.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was great to talk about this with you.
This episode was recorded on May 25, 2021.